Well, good morning, everybody.
Yeah.
Good morning.
I'm Ricky Ellison. I'm the founder and CEO of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. We were founded in 2003, right after my gentleman that's going to speak, Dave Trachtenberg, helped move the ABM Treaty and release that ABM Treaty. And we were formed to help educate the American public. Our mission, and we believe fiercely, that missile defense and deployment of missile defense makes our world a safer place and a much more stable place. And we're seeing that today. Our president is engaged in talks. We haven't seen testing or nuclear testing from North Korea. And the huge achievement last year of our GPI shooting down a realistic target representing a North Korean threat gave, I believe, great confidence to our nation and to be able to engage in those type of talks. So we continue to believe and press forward a partnership globally with our allies to get as much of that capability out and about. We're here today to sort of open up the discussion on something that's not really visible from the public perspective, but the C2 command and control of a cross-domain missile defense capability. We are transitioning from a single threat, ballistic threat, that we have become very good at defeating and negating, to a near-peer competition. And near-peer competition in other domains, especially space. And we are developing systems, both sensors, terrestrial. We're going to be developing systems in space to have sensors and interceptors that are going to be in various domains, and being able to coordinate what that best sensor is and what that best shooter is, and be able to give it to your solution set and firing control without much latency is the future, is where we have to go to win and to deter capabilities that we're facing down the threat. So we are very honored to have, you know, an acquisition expert here, honored to have a warfighter here, and our policy person expert here, and you can see a combined viewpoint of how they're looking at this problem to resolve and to create solutions to make our country more capable than it is in bringing those different domains together and getting a command and control aspect of it. So we're going to have probably a 5 to 10 minute discussion from each of our presenters, and then we will open up the floor to questions. I would ask you to refrain from questions on the MDR. This is a cross-domain discussion here on C2. Just keep it that way. So our first speaker today, Rich Ritter, who spoke with us with Sam Greaves back in 2015 when he was the head of SMDC. And Rich is coming from MDA, where they have the cross-domain C2 for a system, for a linear system that is in operation, which is a ballistic missile defense system that they have created, developed, and put forward, and is operational. So I think it's one of the only in the world that crosses all those domains and is effective today. For his title, he's been involved in missile defense since he was with the Strategic Defense Initiative in September 1990, and he currently serves as the Program Executive for Command, Control, Communications, Computer, Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance for the Missile Defense Agency. Rich, it's all yours.
Yeah, thank you. Many of you in the audience I've worked with, worked for, or whatever in the last year, so you kind of know where I'm headed on some of these things. Let me spend a few minutes first defining what cross-domain, the way I perceive it, what it really means, and then go into what's neat driving missile defense from an acquisition standpoint. It'll depend on the operators that go carry over the next part, and then where we are in C2BMC. You know, traditional warfighting, we think of air, land, sea. But those worlds is starting to evolve and change, and you've probably seen some of the discussions by our leadership of there's a new domain in cyber and space. And the real trick of the whole deal is we don't fight land wars, we don't fight space wars, we fight war. And all these domains have to be integrated and work together to accomplish the overall goals. One of the features of the new domains, cyber and space, is it gives it global context. If I'm going to make a reaction in space, that affects lots of COCOM. So you need coordination across the globe. You also need an ability to understand what the effects are on the ground. So you need a mechanism where folks can coordinate. And this actually drives the very nature of the cross-domain C2, and something we've had to work with some time in the Missile Defense Agency. So what drives on a missile defense? It's not some of you, particularly previous commanders that are all out here that I worked with. The cross-domain is not a unique feature. Missile defense has been dealing with it for a long time. By very doctrine, I take it out in the air, but I can also take it out on the ground. So I have to have cross-information across the folks. It's a team sport that crosses domains, crosses services, and crosses the COCOMs. A ballistic missile from one AOR, a threat, may be actually attacking another AOR. You need a mechanism where the combatant commanders, who have the legal authorities to execute the war, have a way to coordinate. You hear the expression left to launch, right to launch. You need a way to be able to exchange information, know what's going on, and coordinate those activities. It's the basic function of command. There's scenarios, and we have a lot of these that we practice. There's scenarios where we have a sea-based upper tier that may be an upper layer for a Patriot unit on the ground. Cross services, but you're all fighting one battle for the purpose of the combatant commander, and typically it may be a soldier located in an Air Force AOC that's actually coordinating the fights. So we've had to work this for some time. In the case of longer range threats, and most of you in the audience wouldn't be surprised, that is the ultimate cross-domain, cross-the-board. A space asset will actually do the initial detection and queuing. They typically run by the Air Force. It'll go to sensors that may be land and land, sea, or air, and that'll give you final target conclusions or whatever, and it'll be passed to a shooter to go engage, and it may be right now an Army or a Navy troop. So we've had to deal with this cross-domain, cross-service thing for some time. C2BMC, as Ricky identified, is really our mechanism for integration across the domain. Right now, it's 24/7 operations across 17 time zones. We have functionality in 5 of the COCOMs, including the Joint Chiefs area. From there, we can watch what's going on across the world and provide situational awareness and the tools that the combatant commanders need to coordinate, plan, and engage in the fight. What we've been adding lately is also a space. We've been connected into the space domain. We can machine-to-machine now task overhead assets. We can for tasking instructions or for data dissemination to take greater advantage of that sensor capability too. As I mentioned, missile defense is a team sport and includes not just the U.S. assets, often in many of the theaters, it also includes the allies. So we've had to work out those relationships and what is the safest, secure way to exchange information between our allies and provide and to coordinate the fight. In summary, the warfighting is evolving, and we're working with the operational community. In some cases, as an acquisition guy, you got to think ahead a little bit and give them the capability. Realize when a war starts, you may not be given your deck of cards that you thought you were going to give. You need the flexibility to be agile and to reconfigure to go meet a particular need. I think we have done this now for at least 20 years. We got a good capability that's out there, and we're going to need continued support for that capability as warfighting evolves over time. And that's all I have right now. Subject to your questions later.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Our next speaker is Ricky Smith. He is leading the charge for General Townsend on the cross-domain movements that I think 1.5 is where we're at today. You just had a big conference a couple months ago with Lieutenant General Walsh and Townsend moving the ball here. So he's going to give you an Army perspective, a warfighter perspective on what's needed for the cross-domain. Mr. Smith was appointed as the Army Senior Professional for Capabilities Development in June 2009. He represents Training and Doctrine Command at Joint Interagency, Multinational, and Service Staff Forums in the National Capital Region. He engages with the Army Staff, Army Secretariat, Office of Secretary of Defense, members of Congress and their staff, the Joint Staff, and academic organizations to identify, develop, and synchronize capabilities for the current and future Army.
Thanks, Reed. By the way, I'm not leading it. I don't even get to ring the bell. But I will say I think I can give you a perspective on where the Army as part of the Joint Force is in our concept development. But first, you need to take a gander back. In October past year, we introduced our updated operations doctrine. In doctrine, we say we can do it today. So in Field Manual 3.0, it is large-scale, high-intensity major combat. So bring that back, make sure you can do it. It is a leader development challenge, as much, even more so than an equipment challenge. So as we look to the operational environment in the future, we're seeing some key areas. The Joint Forces contested in all the warfighting domains, as mentioned, as well as across the electromagnetic spectrum and in the information environment. So, you know, as hard as it is to do war, we just get more complicated. We also see that that complex environment is going to be increasingly lethal. Our adversaries are working on ways to inflict damage on our systems and on our soldiers, Marine, airmen, and sailors. The other part is that this challenges our ability to deter, because if they don't think you will use that force, or if you don't have adequate force at the point of need, then it gives the possibility of miscalculation or aggression. So we're looking at that very closely. On the environmental side, we see urban, dense urban environment. So if you think missile defense is hard or countering air is hard, just put it inside of a mega city, then it becomes exceptionally difficult, both in terms of communications and the ability to acquire and address targets. So as we look at that, the Army vision recently released by Secretary Esper emphasizes that deploy, fight, and win decisively, but the words joint, multi-domain, high-intensity conflict, it is about modern warfighting doctrine, and we're referring to that. It's emerging in a concept work called multi-domain operations. So while we have something on multi-domain battle, which sounds more cross-domain, one-to-one, if you will, in our current doctrine, we are bringing forward our version of a concept for multi-domain operations. So as hard as it sounds with all the domains, imagine being supported and supported simultaneously across all of them. And that's really where we have to get to achieve the synergy we see. Now, as you look at potential adversaries, I'll take two from the National Defense Strategy, China and Russia. Think of Russia as an artillery army with tanks. So they have retained this ability for long range, and it's about physical standoff, and then they also do many activities in the information environment to keep us at bay. On the Chinese side, we see them working on systems warfare, and it directly confronts and goes after not all of your entities, but of your ability to mission command and control. They want to disaggregate us. And so that is something we have to then bring more robust capabilities, and that's why this effort in cross-domain command control is so important. These anti-access and keeping us at bay to deny us area activities through standoff had to be confronted at the same time threats are evolving and improving. Think about autonomy and semi-autonomous systems, air and ground. Swarm UAVs come to mind. We see directed energy and hypersonic weapons coming. And really, the quantum computing and processing big data. So that may be part of our solution in command and control in the future, but it's definitely going to be something we face on the other side. So the central idea for multi-domain operations from the Army's work that we are working with the Air Force, the Navy, and Marines is the ability as part of the Joint Force to compete daily, to penetrate and disaggregate even when they're working on anti-access and aerial denial systems, defeat the enemy, and then consolidate gains. So several key questions, but part of that is how do you do that in terms of penetrating and going in to disaggregate? The C strike, most people kind of, okay, you find it and you hit it. But we also add to that stimulate C strike, because they won't turn on their systems unless they feel like there's enough threat. Because when we can acquire, the U.S. generally has the ability to provide countermeasures. So how we go about creating simultaneous pressure at mid and long range matters for the joint force at all times. And we want there to be uncertainty on the opposing side, mainly so that we don't have to use it. But when we do, we want to make sure we provide multiple dilemmas. And so as we think about cross-domain maneuver, maneuver being the movement to relative position of relative advantage, going back to deception, going back to the ability to fire, I note that the ability to provide the countermeasure, if you will, the launch, acquired some other way, but you can only do that if you can share information at all echelons. So as hard as it is when you have 30 entities, think in terms of hundreds of thousands, because that's how many soldiers and Marines will be on the ground spread out, especially in things like dense urban terrain. And so as we go forward, we're looking for greater speed, accuracy, and synchronization. Now, the six priority areas the Army's working on in modernization, long-range fires, future vertical lift, next-generation combat vehicle, the network, soldier lethality, and air missile defense. But when you look inside of every one of those, you're going to find a network piece, because if you cannot do mission command, you cannot handle command and control. So as we go forward, things like artificial intelligence is just as important as ultra-secure communications or directed energy, those kind of things that kind of come to mind when you think about countering air and missile defense or air and missile systems. We've taken some steps to bring back what we allowed to atrophy. It was a good risk choice at the time, but we took short-range air defense down to very, very small capacity, and we limited it because we were fighting the one we were in. So after a decade and a half more, we need to revitalize that. So you'll see that in the recent maneuver short-range air defense, and the I in front of that is initial, because we do see it coming forward and being able to add additional assets to that. And so you don't have a one-trick pony vehicle. You need to be able to do electronic warfare. You need to be able to shoot down UAVs. You need to be able to counter missiles if you can from those systems. And then the next step is to continue the multi-layered air defense, because what we have above, we also need to bring from the bottom, and so that we can create that multiple-layer air defense, and the key to that will be a mission command network that's capable of sharing that information. In the area of modernization priorities in science and technology, I've talked about directed energy. Also think about long-range, high-probability-of-kill capability. We're increasing range on cannon tubes, and a lot of that allows us to do suppression of enemy air defense, which is key to then allow the world's greatest air force to do the job we need to do. And then as we go forward, we have to work on the sensor array on platforms, because they have to be able to deal with electronic warfare. I mean, they're going to try to unhinge us and desegregate us in that. You know, unfortunately, sometimes the best people to jam a U.S. Army element is the U.S. Army. So we have to work on that in that deconfliction, and that is, as you can imagine, in electromagnetic spectrum, a very significant challenge. So I'd be glad to field any of your questions. We are moving forward on force structure. At the end of the day, the equipment is actually not the most expensive. So we are moving forward with short-range air defense battalions and bringing them to life as we go, and that manning is has to be done, but it also means you got to get the soldiers, you got to educate them, you got to train them and bring them forward, as well as buying the kit. And that's thanks, what I've got.
Appreciate it. Our next speaker, I'm just pumped up because both of us went to the same school together at the same time in 1978 under Bill Van Cleve at USC, indoctrinated in that movement that Bill was, which you got the chance, obviously, to help break that ABM treaty and move forward with where you're going today. So it's a treat to have the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy for the United States of America, Mr. David Trachtenberg.
Ricky, thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation to be here with my colleagues, and thanks to MDAA for allowing me to participate in this discussion. I was thinking on the way over of what I should say in the limited period of time I have, and I was reminded, you know, of the old story of the individual, the guest speaker who was given 10 minutes to make remarks. He thought he was the absolute world's expert on the topic, and he got very indignant when his host told him he had 10 minutes, and he said, "How do you expect me to tell this audience everything I know about the subject in 10 minutes?" And his host looked at him and said, "Well, sir, I advise you to speak slowly." So I will try to speak slowly. I am not a technical expert, nor am I an acquisition expert, but I did stay at a Holiday Inn Express. And I would like to, just basically from a policy perspective, focus my comments in a couple of areas. First, I agree with what's already been said by Ricky and by Rich before him. I don't think from a policy perspective there's any disagreement here on what it is we are talking about. I'm especially pleased that we're having this conversation on C2 and cross-domain environment, because I think for a while the entire C2 effort has been seen, perhaps in the public domain, as sort of like the family cousin twice removed. And what I mean by that is most discussions of missile defense seem to revolve around the hardware. Okay, so we're talking about the shooters, or we're talking about the sensors. We're talking GBIs or SM3s, SBS, SBX, SSTX, all those systems and acronyms that we all know so well. I think it was I think you, Ricky, said that C2 is not really visible from a public perspective, and I think it doesn't get talked about much. But I would argue that the command and control, the C2 element, is really the glue that holds these systems together. It's what makes them effective. So C2 BMC is an essential element of the ballistic missile defense system. And frankly, without the ability to command and control these systems, without the ability to integrate the C2 capabilities, one could argue that our missile defense capability is essentially ineffective against a range of threats that are out there. So that's one reason why I think this particular discussion focused on the C2 element is a very timely one. It's also, not that long ago, I can recall, when we were debating whether or not missile defense in general was a good thing or a bad thing. Whether it was stabilizing or destabilizing, or whether our focus should be on theater missile defense or what was then called national missile defense. I think some of you may be young enough to remember those debates as well as I do. Today, the focus has clearly shifted. We are well beyond that, thanks to MDAA's efforts and the efforts of others and the Missile Defense Agency to develop these capabilities and actually go forward and actually deploy a missile defense capability. But today, the issue really is how to make these systems, our systems, operate holistically, and how to integrate them effectively to maximize our capability. And this is important because the missile threats that we face today as a country are evolving. They are becoming trans-regional. I think, Rich, you talked about the trans-regional nature of these threats. It is true. A missile can be launched from the CENTCOM AOR, and it can go to EUCOM AOR, the PACOM, Indo-PACOM AOR. We are talking about trans-regional threats. As ballistic missile capabilities proliferate, as ranges of ballistic missiles extend, they create a multitude of problems and issues. And of course, we're not only talking here about ballistic missile threats, but a whole host of other types of missile threats as well, including cruise missile threats, which present their own unique challenges, as well as hypersonic threats as well. So from a policy perspective, I would argue that it's probably time, if not past time, to start thinking of missile defense not in terms of the individual sort of stovepipe programs that the services operate. Let's not think of missile defense as particular Army programs. Let's not think of PAC-3 or THAAD. Let's not think of missile defense in terms of Navy missile defense, Aegis ships, SM-3 interceptors. Let's think of missile defense in terms of a unified, integrated, joint capability. And as well, let's consider ways to integrate our missile defense capabilities, land, sea, space, all of those domains, cross-domain, is absolutely essential. I would say in terms of, I would make three sort of general policy points. The first is I think it's key that we integrate our missile defense capabilities against all types of missile threats. So, you know, I mentioned ballistic, cruise, hypersonic. That is key. Why? Because that's the world that we face. And that is increasingly the world that we are going to face. And so we're going to have to find out actually deploy capabilities to address that multitude of threats. Secondly, I think the issue was mentioned in terms of offense-defense integration. I think our ability to defeat missile threats goes beyond individual systems, and it goes beyond active defenses. There are passive defenses. There are offensive capabilities that we have. All of these types of capabilities brought together by robust command and control capabilities, netted together, integrated together, I think are essential to addressing the overall missile threat and the missile challenges that we face. And third, I think it's an absolutely essential point to note that we in the United States need to continue to work with friends and allies abroad to integrate them into the overall missile defense system. And that requires, obviously, a lot of diplomatic effort. It requires a lot of military-to-military consultation. And it involves the allies also recognizing that we have a tremendous amount that we need a tremendous amount of capability, and that their systems, many of our allies are working on their own missile defense types of capabilities, but they also need to be integrated to the kinds of capabilities that we bring to the table. And that also includes the command and control element. It also certainly includes the C2 piece of that. And being able to net their capabilities and to integrate architectures and developments so that we have a system that is truly global in nature, global in scope, that can address a variety of threats, not just the ballistic threats that we face, I think is absolutely critical. So I don't want to discount in any way the role that allies can play in addressing these challenges. And I think all of those things are consistent with the comments that both Rich and Ricky have made. I won't belabor the point in terms of sort of the evolution of the threat. It is correct, as Ricky noted, that the 2018 National Defense Strategy has sort of refocused our efforts, clearly, on Russia and China, and has sort of emphasized that we now face a security environment that is more complex and arguably more volatile today than it has been in recent memory. And those are the kinds of challenges that we need to address. We are looking within the department at what Russia is doing. We're looking at what China is doing. We're looking at what North Korea has been doing. Yes, there are potential opportunities on the horizon to change the nature of that relationship, which we hope you know, we can be optimistic about, but we're also realistic and clear-eyed in terms of what past history has demonstrated. But nevertheless, we need to be clear-eyed about the evolution of the threats out there. We also look to Iran also. You know, we see the development of Iranian capabilities and how those capabilities being developed not just by Iran but by other adversaries or potential adversaries as well, look to these kinds of systems as ways to coerce either the United States or friends and allies in order to achieve whatever their foreign policy or national security objectives are. So the threat is out there. The threat is clear. We have made some very significant strides, not only on the hardware and the software, but in the integration and in the command and control types of architectures here. But clearly more needs to be done. The message I would leave you with is that from a policy perspective, we are absolutely four square behind the effort to move out in sort of a holistic way, to make sure the capabilities are as integrated as possible, to break down the stovepipes wherever we can, wherever it makes sense to do that, to bring allies on board to work with us, including in the C2 cross-domain environment, and to move forth so that we tackle this problem on the global basis in which it sort of presents itself. So I think, you know, I'll go ahead and stop there and turn it back to you, Ricky, and open it up to questions. But I think we're in general agreement here on the importance of this particular aspect of the missile defense issue.
Thanks, Dave. I'd like to kick off the first question, and then we'll open it up. And I'd like to ask Rich, since in Dave's theme, since you've got a C2 BMC that's operational, that's cross-domain, how do you adjust that to the hypersonic and future possibility, which is not in your mission set yet, but cruise missile defense over the horizon? Is that an integrated single picture, or is that separate pictures, or how, and not just for the U.S. homeland first, but also in the regional fights, how do we coordinate that type of look? I mean, it's been said that a single integrated air picture is too difficult to do. So I just wanted to see, as an acquisition guy, what your recommendations are.
Yeah, we're already moving out on the Hyperglide vehicle. From a defense standpoint, the department has designated us to be the lead agency on the defense side, not the offense side. What I can talk about here is we've done a lot of work already. We're working with our space folks. One of the things you really want to see is this thing is flying low, and you want to be able to track it through its whole course of action. So we've been engaging heavily with our space community and figuring out how to get the data and track it. But there's a couple of key things we're kind of working. You know, with a ballistic missile, when it goes up, you pretty well know where it's going to come down. You got an impact point. We've been working with the operators, and that when it's a hyperglide, doing this all over the place. How do you indicate on a screen, make data useful so he knows he's under attack or what? It sounds simple, but we worked a lot with the operators to get their feel on what is representative and what is useful versus what is not useful. So, yeah, we're all in. We think the infrastructure can be adapted to go do what we said. And we're all in on the hyperglide stuff. I'd like to add one other thing that I should add in my other one. As an acquisition guy, we have a tendency to go back, well, this is my domain, I'm not going to pay for this or whatever. But what we've been able to do is, you know, I'm a sensor enterprise type individual. A sensor's a sensor. It doesn't know whether it's doing missile defense, technical intelligence, space situational awareness. It's the application at the end that determines it. So to the extent possible, we've been exposing the data to the other critical mission areas, and that has allowed us a give and take back and forth to the community. Some data we have is very useful to the space community. Space community's got data that's very useful for us. So we're opening up those stovepipes across the domain to be able to share the data, and particularly the focus is on the Hyperglide. You're absolutely correct.
Where do you see your role with cruise missile defense? Is that sharing some data, or is that separate to the services?
No, I think two parts. One is from a C2 perspective, C4 ISR, and that is definitely ours because we got the structure you can take advantage of. I think the department's still weighing through what are the best options for the kill mechanisms and that, and that'll fold out over time unless the secretary's got a different point of view. We're still working our way through those kind of issues. We're in the process of going through an AOA, looking at the various options. We've gotten approval to go look across the department, and that stuff is still being sorted out. And that's about the most I can say here.
Thanks. All right, let's open up for questions. Anybody in the audience?
Here's Gordon.
Yeah, Herb Kemp, One Alpha Corporation. All of this is good. You know, we talk an awful lot about needing to do integrated air missile defense in depth. Some would argue that it's both necessary, but alone is insufficient. At what point do we also include counteroffensive in that? At what point do we include going left of launch against the missiles? Is that part of the doctrine? Is that part of the technology?
I would say it's certainly part of the approach that we're taking, is trying to look across the range of activities in order to deal with the range of threats we face. So when we talk about missile defense, some call it missile defeat. There are various approaches that can be taken, which is why I said it's not just sort of the active defense component, although that is of course important, but there are other capabilities as well, and you're right to call them out. That is something that the department is looking at across the board. So definitely, there are pieces of each element of those, whether it's active defense, passive defense, whether it involves offensive capabilities, whether it involves cyber, whatever. There's various piece parts to this that from a policy perspective, we want to address and we need to address when we look at the scope and magnitude of the issue that confronts us.
Let me offer an analogy that people, because I hate the drawing that makes it look like a snow dome or a globe, the impenetrable, So think of it as Swiss cheese instead, or we can punch our own holes, because how you go in through either a cyber and something of that, or physically go in, but people thinking that as a one singular. If you can knock out the sensor, you don't necessarily have to take out the shooter, but you've got to find the right sensor. So we'd approach it from the aggregate joint force, and because it's not just access, it's access for what. And so I would tell everybody, every time you see the dome drawn, just punch a few holes in it, and that makes it a lot more realistic as the start point, because nobody has got it that tight.
Ashley Tressel, Inside the Army. What are some of the foreseeable challenges with the boost phase interceptor, and does the Army have a role in that? So, two separate questions.
She said Army.
Yeah, I know, but it's just a boost phase interceptor.
Yeah. Well, boost phase, as you know, is a difficult problem time-wise and whatever. So we're re-energizing, looking at those areas and what the technologies are. Sure, it may not be kinetic. It may be laser or other things. So all those options are on the table, and they're still going through it.
Yeah, from a policy perspective, I would agree with that. We're looking at a variety of options, including the directed energy and non-kinetic kill capabilities as well. So absolutely concur. This may be one of the areas that has where our focus has been reduced in the recent past, where we want to try to perhaps re-energize a focus and emphasis on this, to look at this in terms of game-changing types of technologies. So that's part and parcel of the overall approach that we're taking in the department.
Hey, Justin Doubleday with Inside Defense. Just wondering if you can give us an idea of what's behind the delay in the missile defense review and more than I see that coming.
coming out soon.
Soon.
I want to just introduce you, John. This is Captain John Lips. He has been our Missile Defender of the Year twice, once in the Pacific and once in Europe. And so he's going to shed a little light, I hope, on NIFCA and what the Navy, how the Navy does cross domain. Well, in that aspect.
Unfortunately, no, sir. I'm not. Thank you for the invitation. I am actually here to support an MDA tabletop that starts tomorrow, and I received the invitation in a timely manner that allowed me to be able to roll X in from Kappler from Italy to here. So, gentlemen, thank you for your thoughts and your comments. A quick observation. One, I applaud greatly the dialogue about the inclusion of the Allies, both from my experience in the Pacific Theater and then as well as my current assignment into the European Theater, because their contribution is just as vital, just as critical as the entire joint force, quite frankly. When you look at dispersion of sensors, dispersion of engagement systems, but then also C2. And that leads me really to my comment, perhaps Mr. Ritterback, more in the line of, while we talk about C2B and C being agnostic across from a sensor perspective in a conveyance, I think in light of great power competition, one of the things that it's not clear to me, is when I think of the missile defense system as it was originally envisioned, had been almost the antithesis of a response to a great power competition. And if I look at high-end integrated air and missile defense as it's matured over my career, it is, in fact, the highest form of great power competition, especially if we start to include the effects of low Earth orbit in space and what that's going to mean to elevate the fight into that domain. But the other piece that is just as critical in the great power competition is the execution of that fight from phase zero on upward. And so a C2 system that's able to respond from a planning perspective as well as the execution, I think, is absolutely critical. And so I know that the fielded C2BMC allows us to do that across the joint force. I'm assuming that as we field the son of C2BMC moving forward, we'll provide that same type of capability, or is that better?
You got exactly where we're headed. I don't disagree.
And John, I would just add, even a reference to phase zero, in this world, it's always competition, and you may go into armed conflict. No one's giving us any time off. It's a constant. So that in-stride change, as I used the analogy earlier, it's a biplane going to a single wing, but we don't get to land. So that's the way it's going to be as we work forward.
I think my fleet commander would say that if we do our job properly in the phase zero, we preclude the evolution to conflict,
yeah, quite frankly. And stay across the globe constant, though. That's the challenge.
I think you got my theme, too. We concentrate on phase three or whatever. We got this gigantic fight underway. But it's interesting, because I had this conversation with the folks this morning. Phase zero is equally important. And phase zero doesn't necessarily have the raid sizes that everything you have to worry about. But as we went through the last 2 years, it's a tremendous drain on supportability, logistics, and everything else. And the other problems you have, you just got to make damn sure you don't accidentally shoot. So the control aspects of the thing are actually more difficult in phase zero. And I'm glad you're going to be at the war game, because that's kind of one of the things I'm kind of pushing. We kind of think bolt out of the blue, war start, and everything else. There's usually, you would expect, a continuum reaching up to that thing. And particularly on the Navy, what this drain has been on your guys' fleets. So it is something we got to address more. So I totally agree with everything you're saying.
And thank you, John, for reemphasizing the importance of the Allies' role in this, Allies and strategic partners. I mean, this really is sort of one fight, and it's not just joint U.S., it's joint with partners as well.
In fact, in it, I disagree. I'm going to add one thing. The difficulty is everybody just assumes you can plug in and everything works. And we went through FS-17 together and a few of the other ones. The fact of the matter, what you call a shot and the state vector are not different. So getting everybody to come up to a standard set of
data
standards that everybody works off, that you use the same geo-reference on the Earth, that you can pass stuff back and forth. It's not a trivial issue. We've gone a long way doing it, but as that was mentioned before, hyperglides and that, we got a new world we got to deal with. It's not ballistic anymore, and how are we going to handle that, and how are we going to share it with our partners? I totally agree with you.
Gentlemen, can you guys share your thoughts on, in light of the great power competition, and maybe follow up to your kind of your line of thinking, sir, is what does that do to distributed battle management, command and control? Taking it out of what has been traditionally maybe more centralized nodes, and putting that, and acknowledging the fact that those will be targeted by an adversary. They are pristine targets that are going to be going after across all the domains. To deny that capability, and what efforts are being taken to push that, either to build on Link 16, IFCA, NIFCA operations, and push that across the services from either a policy perspective or an acquisition perspective?
I think, I guess it's me.
Yeah.
I think we're very distributed. I don't think it changes. As a matter of fact, if anything we're doing, we're bringing more of the capability into various locations in CONUS and reaching back. So we are heading down. We're not going to change off our distributed function. In fact, the matter, they're actually back. We have COCOMs backing each other up and everything else. So we are an agile process right now. That's exactly where we're going and moving. I just can't go to the details here.
Yeah.
Hi,
Jen
Dimasio from Aviation. Can you give us a little more information on where Block Zero stands and kind of how the different services are integrated at this point and how fast you can get them?
What's Block Zero to what?
Well, just this Block Zero that you're talking about now.
Phase Zero. That's the campaigning model and joint doctrine. Phase Zero is when you're not in armed conflict and you're in, and then 1, 2, 3 being the fight itself, the armed conflict. Yeah, so
it's not a program date.
It's not a program.
I thought you were talking about a program.
No. Other question?
Yeah, Kevin Cox from the public. So you talked a lot about the interagency discussions. We've had a lot of success with sharing of sensors and whatnot. But as these newer advanced threats come online, SOL gets more challenging. We've got lots of technical challenges, but I guess does that pose new policy questions in terms of how we're actually going to manage that across all these forces?
I don't think it poses a new policy question. I think, you know, from a policy perspective, there's a degree of continuity here in terms of our approach, in terms of what we need to do. And I think when you mentioned interagency, I think you were talking sort of allies and partners. Or
allies, partners, Air Force, Army,
and joint.
And everyone really has to work together.
No, I couldn't agree more with that. I think there's a substantial level of of cooperation that exists today because of sort of a joint understanding, not only within the interagency, within the services, the COCONs, and also allies and partners in terms of the nature of the threat. So I think whether we're talking about NATO, where the summit is about to take place now, whether we're talking about the Indo-Pacific region or our Asian allies that are looking at some of the concerns there. I think from a policy perspective, there's a general recognition of the problem and the need to coordinate and to work together in order to be able to resolve the issue in a way that is the most effective. So, I mean, based on what I've seen, I've been pleased with that level of interaction and coordination.
I would just add from our view of the way the threat sees us and how we operate together, things like anti-satellite weapons. I mean, we are emphasizing on the mission command side the ability to work degraded But then when you add that to a C2, you better be redundant, you better have the ability to back each other, and think of the speed at which we're asking that to happen. And so at the end of the day, you're not going to become impervious. You just have to build in sufficient redundancy and robustness to do it. And then from the mission command side, you better be able to operate without being told what to do all the time. And that sounds real simple, but it's really not. And so as we work our way through those, I think, as I like to say, no threat ever goes away. They just get worse. I mean, we still see bow and arrow some places. So, I mean, so this notion, there's still ballistic missile threats. And now we got hyperglide. It just doesn't stop.
I think the issue, not disagreeing with anybody here, it's not a policy issue, it's a cultural thing. People got to get used to sharing data. And that's happening right now. You just can't populate the world, everybody have their own sensors. But key to that is the warfighters agree ahead of time what the priority is. And what our success on some of these things, you know, if it's a missile attack, all right, you go to the top. But there's a lot of things that support space situation awareness and other things that you can still track the data and pass it to somebody to help make a decision. A lot of data, well, you know, we pass on to the intel guys or whatever. So the trick of the thing is pre-planning, lay out, you know, if this circumstance goes, what am I going to do, what here, and what? And people start to feel like they can support multiple missions, not just multiple domains.
If I could piggyback on that for just a second, I would say resilience here is key. When we're talking about the C2 network, when we're talking about command and control, it has to be robust and it has to be resilient. And of course, you know, there are all kinds of network threats out there that we need to guard against. We can't allow the command and control of systems and capabilities to be vulnerable or to break. I mean, how many of you have had like your email hacked or things like that? I mean, we know today we face those kinds of threats, which a dozen years ago we may not have faced, to this degree. And so when it comes to ensuring the efficacy and effectiveness of our missile defense capabilities, we know that the command and control, which is an essential component, must be both robust and resilient in the face of all kinds of threats.
And if I may add one thing, one of the things we've been working with the COCOMs, command control, everybody thinks of the bullet, but the fact of the matter is the sensor management is equally important. So one goes down, how do you pick up the load, how do you shift, and we do practice that, and we do it every day to support the Secretary's comment.
Thank you very much for your comments in regards to the allies. We appreciate that. My name is Bernie White. I'm from the Australian Embassy. So I understand that the journey between the services to move from compatible to interoperable to integrated is a hard journey. A journey for allies is the same kind of journey. I'd be interested in your comments as to how you see that, probably in a policy sense, in regards to allowing allies access and giving us an opportunity to join. Joining the conversation.
I think that's a valid point, and I think absolutely, there is a policy component to that. We want to do whatever we can in order to integrate allies into the system, share information where we can. Australia, in particular, has been a great partner when it comes to these kinds of capabilities. I think there's even an Australian-American leadership dialogue taking place here. So there are a number of opportunities where we engage or seek to engage with allies and partners in order to try to open the aperture a little bit as much as we can when it comes to the sharing of information so that we can, rather than complicate the problem, simplify the problem and get to an appropriate solution. So I take your point, absolutely.
I agree that I just came, that's why we were late. So we were at that.
From the dialogue.
From the dialogue.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'll try again. Along those lines, where are the services in integrating the command and control systems and adopting the standards that are needed to, so that the systems are compatible, or NIFCA with fighter planes?
All right, let's break into pieces. On the C2BMC, it's a joint, MDA's got the lead, but it's a joint program effort. There are soldiers, sailors, and airmen managing the sites and the equipment. We're responsible to keep it upgraded and operating. They operate it and use it and do that part. It was an agreement a while back that it's a system that crosses all service elements, and the Air Force, MDA should maintain the lead for technical integration and that kind of thing. When it gets to NIFCA, and I got to talk over to John, you're talking about the more the integrated fire control, which is different than command and control. And those aspects are, we got efforts underway to go look how do we integrate those things together, but they're still in its preliminary stages.
Yes, sir. And it would, you know, not to be evasive, but it would be inappropriate for me to speak about the surface equities with regards to NIFCA, because that's not my position. There are great capabilities that are being fielded, and I think that they support the direction of the department as we look specifically at this mission set. With regards to how the Navy integrates or employs it, that's, I can't speak to that.
And we do reach out to them, as well as the Army with IBCS. So, I mean, there's work underway. We really can't go into any much more detail. So there is technical and operational, a lot of other reasons that it's more difficult.
Hey, Rich, just following up that, where is the Air Force on this? As the Air Force would seem to be the natural leader for air picture coordination and so forth, do they have any skin in the game? Or how do they play that out?
The Air Operations Centers belong to them. We're co-located in those Air Operations Centers. They run Cheyenne Mountain, co-located in those places. So from the command control perspective, a lot of cases were co-located and sharing with their facilities. They also provide the major, after we build it and furnish it over, like major sensor facilities like LRDR, the Hawaiian radar, and those kinds of things. And the Air Force certainly has the space aspects to it. So they're more on the sensor and the C2 aspects. They're the ones that actually do the, typically in an AOC, an Army AEDC may be located in that facility. So if there's any a purple mission, it's air and missile defense. That is integrated by its very nature way before MDA ever existed.
And that's not only domestic. We have overseas overseas combined air operations centers.
Correct.
As well. Where the Air Force and others are responsible for integrated air and missile defense capabilities, as well as other capabilities.
And we share with NATO over there too.
Absolutely.
So, for instance, you have the BIMDOC that's over in Ramstein that's got a separate air picture for missile defense and the AOC. Clear that up.
The BIMDAC is the NATO portion of the BMD, and they own and operate it with U.S. funding, and that goes in it as well. Not the whole thing, but they contribute as part of the NATO. But that ties into the Air Operations Center, which is U.S. only, if you've been to the base, on the other side of the base. So they're sharing the same picture. But as you know, there's a lot of things going on in the theater, not all missile defense. So those things that need to go to NATO. Those things that don't, stay within the U.S.
And when you start adding hyper and all those threats into that, gets it very
We'll work our way through it. Right.
It's tougher.
So it's not going to be one picture. It's going to be separate for the commander to look at.
You know, everybody wants one picture, but what does that mean? I've seen a picture where you got everything but the kitchen sink on it, and you can't, and you have no idea what it is. The ability to go share
some of those MDA briefing slides.
That's true.
MDA briefing slides. I like that.
So, you do have the ability to superimpose all the data on one screen. That's not that hard.
You've got a question? Okay, I think that concludes it. Rich, do you want to have any closing statement before we leave? And Rick,
no.
You good?
I'm good.
No, I did. It's a joint mission.
I mean, at the end of the day, this while services do train, maintain, equip, but how you operate, how you fight is always joint. And so I think the agency is moving in that direction, and we're all part of that one team.
I think this discussion shows pretty much how far we've come when we spend an hour talking about these kinds of issues. These would be some of the other issues that we talked about years ago, and I really appreciate being a part of this discussion. So I thank you all, and I thank you.
Thank you, Rich, Ricky, Dave. Thanks for everybody joining us, and have a great day. Thank you.
Great. Yeah. Well,